And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a winter storm wall up again, making travel treacherous in Oregon's mountains.
A volunteer group's planting hundreds of native trees trying to save an important waterway.
And later, how a former Portland teacher is turning her artistic skills into a national climate change.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, December 12, 2019. I'm Annette Newell. The National Weather Service has issued a winter storm warning through noon Friday for areas above 4,500 feet in the northern Oregon Cascades. Forecasters expect as much as 2.5 feet of snow. They're also expecting wind gusts to reach as fast as 45 miles per hour. The Weather Service is cautioning drivers that travel could be very difficult to impossible in the Cascades. They're urging people who must travel through the mountains to keep flashlights, food, and water in their cars in case of an emergency. Travelers can keep tabs on the road conditions by monitoring tripcheck.com or dialing 511. Climate advocates in Washington State are calling for an ambitious 2020 session. They want lawmakers to focus on cleaner transportation. KBOO's Althea Billings has more.
As the effects of climate change become more dire, advocates want Washington State lawmakers to take bold action in the 2020 session. Climate groups commend the state's commitment this year to 100% clean electricity by 2045, but say more needs to be done. One key is trying again to pass a clean fuels standard, which was shot down by lawmakers this year. Kelly Hall is state policy manager for the group Climate Solutions. She says British Columbia, Oregon, and California have standards.
It has been one of the most effective policies at cutting emissions in our transportation sector, and Washington is really missing out on the benefits of having this policy that the entire West Coast has.
The petroleum industry predicts it would lead to higher fuel costs. Puget Sound Clean Air Agency is considering a clean fuel standard for its region. Transportation accounts for about half of the state's greenhouse gas emissions and air pollution. Lee Misick manages Washington State Transportation Policy for Climate Solutions, and she says the state also needs to tackle funding for a cleaner transportation sector. Any changes could be hampered by the recently passed Initiative 976, which will limit tax revenue for local transportation projects. A carbon pricing bill is one avenue for funding, although several versions of this measure have failed in recent years. Misick says one creative solution is an air quality surcharge for new or retired vehicles.
This charge would account for a vehicle's estimated greenhouse gas emissions over its life. So more efficient vehicles would pay less, electric vehicles would pay far less given their extremely low to no greenhouse gas emissions.
Mo McBroom, the Government Relations Director for the Nature Conservancy in Washington, says one of the top priorities is governor-requested legislation to update the state's climate emission limits. She says current goals were set 11 years ago, and since then, clearer science on climate change has emerged, but the state has failed to make progress. She adds that new benchmarks would create a better framework for climate decisions.
So it allows activists, advocates, legislators, the business community to think about any given policy choice in the context of what do we need to get done, how far do we need to go, and how far does this policy take us in that direction.
The legislative session is scheduled to begin on January 13th. For KBOO Evening News, I'm Althea Billings. It's your birthday. Time for a party, right? How about getting up early, slogging through mud and rain, and clearing out blackberry brambles? That was how one local woman decided she would celebrate, planting hundreds of trees in the process. KBOO's Annette Newell joined in this party with a purpose, talking with the birthday girl, Pamela Sari.
You decided you wanted to do this for your birthday. We're out here in the mud and the rain. Why is this your ideal birthday celebration?
Well, I wasn't planning on mud and rain. I was planning on dirt, though, to dig in the dirt and plant trees. I think it's a great way for people to get together and give back and also connect to a certain landscape so we can come back a year from now and see how what we've planted has grown and helped the habitat here.
Uh-huh. And this isn't your first time doing this.
Ten years ago you did? Mm-hmm. And today's with Friends of Trees, but that was with Solve.
Uh-huh.
Yep, at Tryon Creek State Park. So different location. Yep.
And how is this going to help the environment here, do you think?
This is a riparian area, so it's at the confluence of Rock Creek and the Clackamas River. So the trees that we planted on this slope will hopefully help with erosion and also create more habitat for the critters here.
Uh-huh.
And the birds!
Does this make you happy?
It makes me really happy.
To see your friends out here?
Oh my gosh, so awesome. Best birthday ever!
Okay, well, thank you for getting me up early on a Saturday.
You did it!
Me to do this. Yay.
I'm so proud of you. I'm proud of everyone for wearing their rain gear. We are covered in mud right now, but it has been so much fun today. So I'm super grateful. Oh, best birthday ever.
Yeah, that's so cool. How many people? It looked like a couple dozen, maybe?
There were 20 in my crew, and then several other crews as well. And we got apparently 500 trees in the ground today.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Are you going to have a cake or something? I mean, is this just it for your birthday?
Eventually, when you're 50, you know, the cake isn't quite as important as important as your relationships.
But
okay. Okay, I'll have cake.
And Max Showers was also there leading the group Friends of Trees. He told me more about why these volunteers give their time to plant trees in our community. We were just out here planting trees for a birthday. How often does that happen?
We have groups from that come out to plant for all sorts of reasons. But I think that we do have a birthday group every now and then, so it's not totally uncommon, but yeah.
And describe what we just accomplished today. What did we do?
So about 50 volunteers came out to plant 500 native trees and shrubs at the confluence of the Clackamas River and Rock Creek out here in Clackamas County.
And why is it important to rebuild this area with native?
So it enhances the native habitat and improves ecological functions. So having a diverse native plant life community will help build habitat for all sorts of different species. It'll help clean water for fish. Especially upland from these two important river or waterways.
Why do you do this? Why is this important to you?
It's a way to embrace community and earth and to kind of heal, as well as get people involved in conservation efforts here in the Portland area.
Okay. If people are interested in Friends of Trees, what can they do to learn more about you guys?
We have a handful of volunteer roles, from planting volunteers to neighborhood coordinators to get people involved in the Neighborhood Trees program. You can be a Friends of Trees ambassador at outreach events, so just check out our website at friendsoftrees.org.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Really
yeah, yeah.
Thank you,
Max.
And again, that was Max Showers with the local nonprofit Friends of Trees, which recently planted 500 native trees and shrubs near the Clackamas River. They have tree plantings on Saturdays and are looking for volunteers. More information is available at friendsoftrees.org.
A recent investigation reports 9 teachers and staff members sexually abused students at a Portland private school over the past 40 years. The investigation started more than a year ago at the request of the Catlin Gabel School's Board of Trustees. The report names another 12 former staff and faculty in the allegations, but their involvement was not corroborated. The report follows years of complaints about inappropriate staff-to-student contact. It spans the last 4 decades of allegations and complaints about staff groping or having sex with students. Many of the victims are now in their 50s and 60s. The report came out Wednesday, and none of the accused are still working at Catlin Gabel. The school's board of trustees launched the investigation after a former student posted on Facebook that a Catlin teacher abused her. The board hired lawyer Lori Watson to conduct the investigation. The school issued a letter of apology to parents saying, quote, "It is clear that Catlin Gabel failed on multiple accounts, on protecting students, in addressing the issue, and in enacting change. Catlin Gabel is billed as an elite private institution. Tuition for the 775-student school costs $35,000. In an effort to support those affected, the school has partnered with RAIN, the nation's largest anti-sexual violence organization. Anyone affected by sexual misconduct is encouraged to call RAIN through the National Sexual Assault Hotline at 800-656-4673 or online at rainn.org.
The lesson of the day is disinfecting for 3 Vancouver elementary schools. With dozens of students calling in sick since Tuesday, reporting cases of stomach flu, some Vancouver public schools are stepping up their sanitizing. Truman Elementary School reported 72 students were out sick on Wednesday and counted 80 absent on Tuesday. Washington Elementary School had 50 absences Wednesday, with dozens in the days prior. The district is closely monitoring Harney School, where 40 students were out on Wednesday. Staff began disinfecting the schools Tuesday. They're urging parents of ill students to keep the kids home until they are free of flu-like symptoms for more than 24 hours. Clark County announced that 18% of their flu tests came back positive, indicating that flu season has indeed arrived. This is now the second week of more than 10% of the kids being ill.
Washington State is preparing to launch a new paid family medical leave program. As Eric Tegedoff tells us, after lawmakers approved it in 2017, it will finally take effect in the new year.
Washington will become the fifth state to offer comprehensive leave, allowing employees to take up to 12, and in some cases 18, weeks off to care for a new child, a loved one, or in the event of a medical emergency. Marilyn Watkins with the Economic Opportunity Institute says some employers in the state already offer leave benefits, but they're mainly for highly paid workers. Most lower-wage workers don't have this option. She says the goal of this program is to make leave accessible to everyone.
They can keep themselves healthy and be as healthy as they can be, that they can really nurture their young children, as well as care for those sick family members in ways that benefit the health and well-being of everybody.
Benefits are funded through a payroll premium of 0.4% that began last January. Watkins says Washington State's efforts to provide leave are different because it has to build the program from scratch. The other four states added paid family leave to their already existing temporary disability insurance programs. Employees who have worked 820 hours the previous year for any combination of employers are eligible. Watkins says Washington learned from other states and will offer the greatest wage replacement to low-wage workers, who make less than half of the statewide average weekly wage, which is $628.
They'll get 90% of their gross wages before taxes and everything are taken out of it, so they'll get pretty close to what their full paycheck would be when they're out on leave, and middle-income workers here in Washington will actually also get higher benefits than they do in the other states that have existing programs.
The website paidleave.wa.gov has more information on how to apply. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Masked gunmen are behind a string of bar robberies in the Portland area. They've struck at least 8 bars within just the last month, all East Side or North Portland neighborhood places with video lottery machines. Portland police have not confirmed that it's the same 2 people who committed all 8 of the robberies, though they're similar. 2 men, armed and masked, appear on video surveillance footage entering Mulligan's Bar and Grill in Hawthorne on November 12th, just before 1 in the morning. The masked suspects took money from the till and tried to force the bartender to open the lottery machines to get their cash. Since then, 2 men with similar attire hit the Tulip Shop Tavern, Lots of Luck Bar and Grill, Cosmo Lounge, Wilshire Tavern, Lombard Pub, and Mock Crest Tavern. All incidents included similar behavior and were executed quickly and confidently, with patrons and property largely ignored. Witnesses at the Mock Crest Tavern heist say the suspects got away in a gold Lexus LS400. The bartending community has been shaken by this, with some saying they feel like sitting ducks. Chris Garcia, owner of Cosmo Lounge in Southeast Portland, told KBOO her concern is that people in the industry be aware and take precautionary measures. The robberies have all happened late evening or near closing time, when the businesses are sparsely attended and staffed.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on an Oregon artist who is turning tons of trash collected from the coast into art that teaches people about protecting the environment. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather, cloudy and cool, down to 44 overnight. Tomorrow's weather, we could be seeing some showers and a high of 50. There is a winter weather advisory in the Cascades until noon on Friday. Today in history, on this date in 2015, the Paris Agreement was adopted by the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. The agreement outlines how to combat climate change and what changes need to be made to build a more sustainable, low-carbon future for the planet. The quote of the day is from climate researcher James Hansen, who wrote, "Halting global warming requires urgent, unprecedented international cooperation, but the needed actions are feasible and have additional benefits for human health, agriculture, and the environment."
As KBOO News reported earlier this week, the Washington Post has released a report showing that U.S. officials misled the public about the war in Afghanistan for almost 18 years. The report called the Afghanistan Papers is the result of multiple lawsuits from Washington Post reporters. It shows senior officials hid evidence and distorted statistics to make it seem like the U.S. was winning the war. Here's the Washington Post reporting team talking about what they found.
I covered the Pentagon for several years as a beat reporter.
That is Craig Whitlock.
I was a foreign correspondent before that. I would go to Afghanistan sometimes. And one thing you would always hear commanding generals say is, we're making progress, or we're turning the corner.
The past 8 months have seen important but hard-fought progress in Afghanistan.
Since I spoke to you almost 16 months ago, we have made much progress.
2011 was a real turning point.
But we are at a crucial turning point.
I think it's possible that by the end of this year, we will have turned a corner.
This would happen month after month, year after year.
Now, last night, I gave a speech in which I said that we have turned a corner.
So I wouldn't suggest to you that we have turned the corner, but I will say we've come a long way since 2003.
You never hear the commanding general say, we're losing.
First, let me just say that we're not losing a war out here by any means.
Or the war's not going well.
I feel like, you know, we're making some steady progress.
I think we have turned the corner. And I think also that the Taliban recognize that that corner has been turned.
Are you telling me that the corner has been turned?
Yes.
Turn the corner.
Now, looking ahead to 2018, as President Ghani said, he believes we have turned the corner, and I agree.
Some lawmakers, like Senator Warren, noted this.
General Miller, we supposedly turned the corner so many times that it seems now we're going in circles.
Since the start of the war, that has been the official line from the government. But now, Craig has obtained a collection of secret recordings and documents that completely unravels that official narrative.
My assessments weren't good. It wasn't things are going well. Never, ever. We are participating in conflict. We are not really here to win.
Thousands of pages, documents, and recordings like these, laying out in private what was never said in public.
They really do bring to mind the Pentagon Papers, which were the Defense Department's top secret history of the Vietnam War.
To me, this is kind of like the Vietnam effect.
After 50 years and counting in Afghanistan, I don't think we're any better organized than we were back then.
In these interviews, we hear from ambassadors and generals and senior diplomats, people like Michael Flynn and Ryan Crocker and Nicholas Burns, who said this war was a mess.
After 2003-04, once we're fully engaged in both wars, I can't remember us ever saying, should we be there? Are we being useful? Are we succeeding?
The just severity of corruption in our own system, I think, is just unbelievable.
And our strategy failed, and we didn't know what we were doing. They literally use those words. While on one hand, it makes sense because people have known the war hasn't been going well, which is why we've been there for 18 years. To hear or read these people who are in charge of the war admitting how the war was screwed up and that what the American people were being told about the wars wasn't true.
You mentioned that one theme that came up in many of these interviews is the fact that people were really concerned about the corruption that they saw. Was that something that Crocker talked about during his interview?
Yes, Crocker was a key player in trying to determine how to respond to that, particularly during his second stint there in the U.S. Embassy in Kabul during the Obama administration. By then, the levels of corruption had gotten very, very bad in Afghanistan.
Very significant military presence. It requires a whole lot of stuff.
You have to remember, at that point, the United States is pumping in billions and billions of dollars a year into Afghanistan, whether it's direct aid, paying for their troops and police, paying to rebuild roads.
You just cannot put those amounts of money into a very fragile state and society and not have it fuel corruption.
So it really ran the gamut, the corruption. It could be Afghan police having checkpoints on the road demanding money for someone to pass, whether you're an Afghan farmer or somebody going to school. But it also was very high-level corruption in terms of one of the biggest banks in Afghanistan, Kabul Bank, went belly up.
Panicked customers have been pulling their savings out of Kabul Bank.
You have to understand, Afghanistan, when we invaded, they didn't have banks. They just had money exchanges, hawalas, which are the Islamic financial system of these money transfers, but they build up a bank, and Hamid Karzai is president of Afghanistan. One of his brothers helped run this bank, Kabul Bank. It was the biggest private bank in the country. This bank also was a repository, directly or indirectly, of most of the U.S. and international aid. All this money, to a large degree, was getting funneled through Kabul Bank. And it became apparent in 2010 that Kabul Bank all of a sudden was on the verge of collapse, that there were rumors flying that they didn't have enough money to cover their loans.
Because it was so mismanaged and because people were theoretically taking money out of the business for their own purposes.
Mismanaged doesn't even cover it. That this is people giving loans to themselves, millions and millions and millions of dollars in loans, and never having to pay them back. So I think the investigators who were looking into it say it was more than mismanagement. It was outright theft and fraud to such a degree that it was run like a Ponzi scheme.
And that's part of a Washington Post podcast about the Afghanistan papers. The Post got more than 2,000 documents through a Freedom of Information Act request 3 years ago. At first, it was rejected. It took several lawsuits to get those documents released. In the 18 years of war with Afghanistan, an estimated 2,300 U.S. troops and 34,000 Afghan civilians lost their lives.
Today, entrepreneur Andrew Yang made a deadline. He'll be the only non-white candidate who will be on stage at the next presidential debate. Here's more on what he and others have to say about that.
I will say, I am proud to be the only person of color who's going to be on that stage.
Today's the deadline to qualify for this month's Democratic debate, and entrepreneur Andrew Yang met the mark just days ago. California Senator Kamala Harris, the only black woman to run, dropped out of the race last week, though she had been slated to participate.
I'm just going to say it plain. It is a problem that we now have an overall campaign for the 2020 presidency that has more billionaires in it than black people.
New Jersey Senator Cory Booker, reflecting on Harris's departure from the race.
It is a problem when an immensely qualified, widely supported, truly accomplished black woman running to lead the party, a party that is significantly empowered by black women voters, didn't have the resources that she needed to continue here to Iowa.
Without Harris, just seven candidates will take the debate stage, all of them white except Yang. For former Housing Secretary Julian Castro, who was not even close to qualifying, the prospect of an almost all-white debate raised questions about the order of state primaries. Supporters of Iowa and New Hampshire's, quote, first-in-the-nation status, unquote, say their retail politics or one-on-one community interactions are important, but others think the relative lack of diversity in those states is a problem.
I'm not interested in changing the rules of the game in the middle of the game. I think that that's unfair to the people that are already there, the candidates. What I am interested in, though, is changing for the future.
Castro says the Democratic National Committee should put together a task force assessing the primary order and make changes as necessary. The Center for Popular Democracy's Jennifer Epps Addison agrees.
The way we set up the primaries is to essentially weed out the field of candidates that folks in Iowa and New Hampshire don't feel represent them, even if those candidates better represent the vast majority of the Democratic base.
But many Iowans, including political party leadership, disagree. Iowa GOP Chairman Jeff Kaufman and Iowa Democratic Party Chairman Troy Price co-authored an op-ed in the Cedar Rapids Gazette recently, saying Iowa's retail politics allow, quote, the future president to connect with Americans in a way few primaries can, unquote. The Iowa State Legislature's Democratic Black Caucus has also come out in favor of Iowa remaining first. Here's its chair, State Representative Akeo Abdul-Samad, who says changing the caucuses would be missing the point.
What stops Latinos from voting isn't the caucus, it's gerrymandering. What's stopping the blacks and Latinos from voting isn't the caucus, it's racism. And so you have other cities, other states that are predominantly people of color that can't elect officials of color because of those issues. So changing the caucus isn't going to resolve the issue.
From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bulkey.
Oregon's U.S. Senators Ron Wyden and Jeff Merkley today introduced legislation to improve water quality and services for tribal communities in Oregon. They say Native American tribes in Oregon and across the West are suffering with aging treatment and distribution systems, causing serious problems such as burst pipes and unsafe drinking water. Merkley pointed to the crisis on the Warm Springs Reservation to demonstrate the need for action. The Tribal Water Infrastructure Act introduced today would help Oregon tribes connect, expand, or repair water systems and authorize the EPA to pay for as many as 10 water improvement projects a year for tribes in the Columbia River Basin and other nearby river basins. It would require that at least one of these projects help Western Oregon tribal governments improve water infrastructure. It would also make the Indian Reservation Drinking Water Program permanent and increase its funding from $20 to $30 million per year. That's important because on the Warm Springs Reservation, residents endured an 81-day boil water advisory this summer and another one in October, and permanent solutions have not been found for all of the water issues.
Water rights are at the heart of another issue in the West. Hundreds of unresolved claims are being addressed in a new agreement that keeps tribes and local governments out of court. The new Montana Tribal Water Agreement also includes management of a national bison range. With that story and more, here's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
The Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes of Northwest Montana would manage the National Bison Range in exchange for concessions on water rights, according to draft legislation Senator Steve Daines is expected to introduce in Congress. Aaron Bolton reports.
Both Daines and the Salish and Kootenai tribes announced last week that they had come to an agreement to settle thousands of water rights claims otherwise destined for court. That settlement is outlined in legislation Daines is set to introduce in the Senate. It would also transfer management of the National Bison Range on the reservation from the federal government to the tribes in exchange for concessions they made on their water rights. As part of the deal, the tribes would agree to lower the amount of federal funding they would receive for an irrigation project by $400 million. Daines said the settlement, quote, will also save taxpayers $1 to $2 million per year, end quote. Daines says those ongoing savings would come from the tribe's management of the bison range, which they have long sought to do. The federal government would hold the range in trust for the tribes. Tribal Chairman Ronald Trahan issued this pre-recorded statement on the exchange.
Restoring the bison range to federal trust ownership for the tribes is an elegant solution that would correct the historic injustice of the United States taking the bison range from the tribes' treaty-reserved homeland without tribal consent.
Daines is expected to introduce the legislation later this week. For National Native News, I'm Aaron Bolton.
A group of South Dakota inmates is raising money to help causes which support missing and murdered Indigenous women and Native health care programs. China Lockett has more.
Cody Hopkins has been an inmate at the South Dakota State Penitentiary since 2015. Hopkins says he wants to help programs he believes in, but his options are limited.
There's so many things in here that we are constantly looking at from the inside out.
Hopkins thought of a way he could contribute through art. He's selling his work and donating the proceeds. 12 inmates have joined him, purchasing supplies and beading identical pairs of vibrant red earrings.
Everything that was invested into this project come from out of our own pockets, the guys here in prison.
Other inmates are creating visual pieces to sell alongside the earrings.
From there, it just kind of went. It was a snowball downhill. I thought of just 25 and then 50, 150 and then 200.
Hopkins' mother helped him connect with people and coordinate the sales. And when the pieces hit social media, it took off. They have a number of pre-orders for the artwork and jewelry, and the rest is expected to sell quickly during the upcoming Lakota Nation Invitational in Rapid City.
I'm really blown away. You know, my mom will read some of the comments, and just for those people to be so excited about them and for them to, you know, just have that pride pays off everything. Speaking on behalf of the guys here, it's something that's very humbling to us.
Proceeds will go to the Red Ribbon Skirt Society for its work with missing and murdered Indigenous women and the Urban Indian Health Center in Sioux Falls. Hopkins hopes to expand the project so other inmates can get involved. For National Native News, I'm China Lockett in Rapid City.
The Puyallup Tribal Council in Washington State passed a resolution this week declaring a climate emergency. The five-page resolution outlines steps the tribe plans to take to address climate change through sustainable practices and policies. Tribal leaders say action needs to be taken now to protect the Salish Sea and natural resources. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The USDA estimates 35% of meat goes unused. Here's Eric Tegedoff with tips so you don't let holiday foods end up in the trash.
The holidays mean lots of big meals and also lots of food waste. But a few tips could help people put those leftovers to good use. Year-round, the U.S. Department of Agriculture estimates 30 to 40% of food is thrown away. Julie Buck is a dietitian. She says one easy way to avoid waste from big meals is to plan ahead and know how many people are coming. Online portion calculators can tell you how much to buy. Buck also suggests learning to love leftovers. She says in her house they're called planovers.
Don't plan 7 days of menus. Plan for a day of reuse and rescue from your fridge, pantry, or freezer. It's a great way to make sure that we're participating in the fullest in those food items that are becoming costly to all of us.
Buck says some food traditionally bound for the trash can be rescued, too. For instance, stale bread can be made into croutons or stuffing, and vegetable tops and bones can be turned into soup stock. There's another option for food before sending it to the landfill. It can help feed someone in need. Buck says check with their local food banks or pantries to see what their donation requirements are.
It can be as small as that extra garden lettuce that you're growing. So check in with them, find out what their criteria is, what days it needs to be delivered, and in what form, if it's fresh, frozen, if it needs to be pre-washed and packaged.
For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, December 12, 2019. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Jeffrey Wade, Jenka Soderberg, Althea Billings, and Eric Tegedoff. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Jeff Henderson. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website, kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings.
And I'm Annette Newell. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's Sojourner Truth Radio with Margaret Prescott, bringing you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories. At 9, it's Beloved Community. John Shuck speaks with Chris Hedges about his book, America, The Farewell Tour. At 10, Radio Zine presents a Between the Covers special, where KBOO's Ken Jones interviews Dan Armstrong, author of the new book, Blake College. At 10:30, it's Film at 11, where the Monday Samplers Fortunato joins the team to discuss unusual holiday movies and more. And at 11, it's The Digital Divide, analyzing how to use science, medicine, and technology to benefit society and keep it from harming us. KBOO is an independent, non-commercial community radio station powered by our volunteers and our members. By making a donation through GiveGuide on kboo.fm/give, you're eligible for more than $4,000 of free and discounted products from your favorite Portland brands. So if you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
If you go to the popular Zoo Light celebration at the Oregon Zoo, you might notice a massive polar bear sculpture. It's beautiful white twinkling in the darkness, but look closer and horror sets in. You realize it's made of trash collected from our coastline. It's one of the celebrated creations of Oregon artist Angela Hazelton Potsey, who joins us live right now. Welcome, Angela.
Hi there. Welcome. Thank you.
Let's focus first on Daisy the polar bear. How did you create her, and what does she represent?
Well, Daisy is one of our many, many sculptures with the Washed Ashore Project, and she's made of marine debris that has been collected along the Oregon coast, and it could be any coast anywhere. We just happen to be located in Oregon, and it's made with, the whole idea of our sculptures is really to grab people's attention with animals that are represented of the ones that are being endangered by plastic pollution in the ocean. And she's sitting on a melting iceberg that is all made with plastic bottles and all kinds of things that we've, cooler lids and everything that is washed up on the beaches. And we don't color or dye anything. It's just the colors we pick up. And I say we because we're an organization that depends on volunteers, and I also have a great staff, and we all work together to make these sculptures.
Hi, Angela. Althea Billings here. So you're the founder and artistic director of the Washed Ashore Project. Can you tell us about how that came about?
Yes. We're almost 10 years old as of next month. We will turn 10 as a nonprofit, and it's really a very personal story on my part, in that I grew up with family of artists. Both my parents were artists, and I married Craig Potsey, who also taught at Portland State University there, and was an art teacher in Portland, and helped start the Buckman Magnet Art School in VSAA as an art teacher. So I was rooted in the arts and education, and I was also an exhibiting artist in the Portland area. And then my dear husband of 25 years died of a brain tumor, and it was rather sudden, and they had a stroke. My whole life was upside down, and I didn't know what to do with my life, and I thought, well, I have to run away to the ocean, because the ocean will be my place that I can count on, that it's never changed. It'll be my place of solace that I can pull my life back together. And I was walking the beaches every day and moved down to Bandon, Oregon, where my family's had a cabin and my grandparents were from. And basically, I was walking the ocean, and I came to the ocean to heal, and really I found an ocean that needed healing. I saw plastic as far as I could see on the beaches and was horrified. And I've always loved Oregon beaches, and I had to figure out what to do to change that. And what I could do is I thought, well, I believe in the power of the arts. I believe that arts are a powerful language, and they can grab people's hearts and minds and turn them around. And so I figured it out and figured I would make giant animals that would make people want their picture taken next to it, and they'd want to go look at it, and then they'd find out what it's made of, and they'd want to stop polluting the oceans and change their consumer habits. So, yeah, so we now have a staff of 10 and thousands of volunteers that work with us in Bandon. But, yeah, that's how it started. It was a very personal awakening, really.
You just mentioned the consumer habits, and this time of year that takes on special meaning during the holidays. What's your message about all this conspicuous consumption and all the trash that we're creating right now?
Yeah, I think sometimes people just kind of set all that stuff aside when they get seduced by the colorful gifts that they want to buy. And, you know, we were sold the whole idea that, you know, plastic is convenient, it's cheap, it's beautiful, it's slick, it's colorful. It comes in every color and everything we've ever wanted, and that's why we have the problem we have with plastic pollution. There's so much of it, and we don't even know it's plastic some of the times when we buy things. We don't even think about it. This is the time of year to really stop and stop in your tracks before you go grab something off a shelf and think about it. You know, can I find a different product that doesn't have plastic in it? Can I avoid the plastic packaging? Of course, you can easily not put it in a plastic bag, and Portland makes that even easier. Thank you very much. But, you know, I think if we stop ourselves and look at what we're buying, we can make better choices. And really, I often tell people, if the next present you buy for somebody, if it's, you know, during the school year when it's a kid and you're thinking about a present for at a party or something, I mean, try to have no plastic associated with it, and it's a challenge. But you'll find you'll buy more things locally. You won't be ordering things in the mail that have to come in plastic packaging. You won't be getting something off a shelf, but you'll be maybe supporting local artists. And you can get something made of wood or paper or cotton fabric or stone or ceramic or something else. And it doesn't take much to just rewire your brain about that. And it's a great time of the year to really test yourself on that. And then there's, of course, the wrapping paper. You know, even if you do paper wrapping, at least you can reuse that and put it in your fireplace if you're building a Christmas fire or something. But try to avoid the foil wrap or the plastic string and all that sort of stuff.
And so are the sculptures made entirely from trash found discarded on Oregon beaches?
They are, and we have processed about 28 tons of garbage off of Oregon beaches into over 80 sculptures at this point. And we tour those all around the country. So we're really excited because in January 24th, we will have our first show at the Oregon Zoo. So we have Daisy the polar bear kind of there as a teaser, but she's about to be joined by a lot of other big animals to educate people more about the subject. So they'll be sprinkled out throughout the zoo coming January. And that's a six-month show, so it'll be there. Actually, longer than 6 months. I think it's an eight-month show, so it'll be there through the whole summer.
Wow, congratulations. Now, you've also had your work displayed at the Smithsonian, both at the National Zoo and the Museum of Natural History. What was that experience like as an artist?
Well, it's a huge honor. I mean, it's just an amazing honor. I was asked by the Smithsonian Museum of Natural History to create a display. It's in a display case in the Sant Ocean Hall. It's been there for over 3.5 years, and it is a turtle swimming through a sea with jellyfish and such. And it was, I was really nervous. That piece. We always have volunteers work on everything, but that one I thought, I just need to do this myself because I'm going to be too picky. But it was also really important because I'd get so involved in the details of doing all the fine work, and I'd like, no, this has to teach. It has to teach. So that's the one trick about our work. You want it to be a work of art that is, beautiful, but we have to have that horrifying edge to it of, oh my God, this is plastic I recognize. There's a lighter, there's a shovel, there's a fork, there's a water bottle. We have to actually have things people see and can take ownership of that they're part of the issue, because all this stuff was once purchased by somebody. We all buy this all the time, and we need to remember we're part of the issue. Every human is.
I am very interested in the fact that you're saying that there's a certain level that you don't want to camouflage what your materials are. Are there sorts of materials that work better for your sculpture style?
Well, it's interesting. When I first started this, I really want to show everything that's on the beach. So I had to design things that where I could use like 95% of everything that comes in. So the only things we don't use are really toxic stuff. Or, things that you're not sure what they are might be a little dangerous to use. So we avoid those. But we really use everything. So the rolled up styrofoam and the styrofoam that comes in that's been rolled by the ocean, that can't be displayed outdoors. But we've created bleached coral reefs out of those by sculpting that. And we just had a show at the Clinton Presidential Center that was two big exhibit halls. And that was also a real honor, and got to even meet Bill Clinton and have him talk about what we were doing. But we really try to use everything, and so that's kind of a great creative challenge. You have to figure out how to use everything and how to turn it all into something. Of course, if it's an outdoor sculpture, we have to make them weatherproof and windproof and all that, so it sort of drives the technique to be very tough. And so we wire and screw everything together.
Your work focuses so much on animals and how they're vulnerable to the effects of so much plastic out there and the climate change as well. Why did that hit home for you? Are you an animal lover?
Well, I think we all are. I think that when I first was trying to conceive what to do about this issue, I thought, I know about public art, and I know that if I wanted to reach the general public. I wanted the people who don't go to art museums. I want the people who might be littering on the beach or the people that never think about art or anything. And the one thing that everybody loves is animals. And also the animals, I work hard to make I do all the heads of the animals, and I really work hard to get the eyes to reach into you and to kind of grab your heart and get expressions in these animals out of garbage. And I knew that, and it has actually worked really well. I mean, we reach kids and adults of all levels, all socioeconomic types. I mean, we've also displayed our work at Disney World and SeaWorld and those kind of places. And we're trying to reach all audiences. So we try to go everywhere, and that's pretty cool. And I think animals are one of those things everybody loves. It's you know, my background is not making animal art at all. And in fact, you know, my work is more abstract in some regards before I started this, and I thought that just doesn't work. The general public doesn't get abstract art as much as they would an animal. And to me, reaching the general public was why I went with animals.
And what is the planning process when you're, you know, thinking of creating a new sculpture?
Well, that's an interesting thing because, you know, at first it was when I started this, it was really what are the materials and what are the right colors and, you know, all that. And also but now that we have quite an inventory of animals and environments, I'm looking, of course I have to look at the materials because we can't go out and buy something. We have to just accept whatever washes in. So we're always sorting things by color and size and shape. And when I see we have enough of a certain color, like for instance, we ended up having our pile of black kept getting really big, and I'm like, well, it's time to make a giant whale tail. No, we can't do a giant whale because it's too big for us to deal with. But you know, all of our sculptures are huge, and so the whale tails, we've now made two giant whale tails, and they each have a 15-foot fluke that comes down, and then the base is like 12 feet by 12 feet. So all of our sculptures are huge, too, and that's the other thing. In order to reach the public, you want something so big you can't ignore it, which means you also have to involve a lot of people when you're doing it, which is actually one of the joys of Washed Ashore to me is that we involve the general public in the creating of the small parts and panels and trash kebabs, as we call them. So people can walk into our workshop in Bandon, and I invite everybody who's listening today to drive to Bandon. And you just walk in the door, and we have an ongoing workshop. You can just come in and sit down and start playing with all this stuff, and we tell you what animal we're working on. And right now, as a matter of fact, we are working on a California condor that will be a permanent piece at the Oregon Zoo. So if people get down to Bandon over the holidays, they can actually put their hands on, you know, making some feathers for the California condor and then be able to visit it on a regular basis at the Oregon Zoo.
You know, you worked with kids so much as an educator. What kind of response do you get from the children specifically when they see these sculptures?
Well, they get it right away. They really do. One of my favorite moments is when we started this, and we were at the Oregon Coast Aquarium back in 2011, and this little boy came running down the ramp there, and he goes, Mom, look, it's just a bunch of wabbish. And it was like, he just got it. It's just all garbage. And kids like, this isn't right. They understand that if this all came from the ocean, this isn't supposed to be in the ocean. This is wrong, and animals shouldn't be eating this, and animals shouldn't have to live with this. And, you know, and oftentimes us adults wake up and start paying attention when our kids around us say, you shouldn't be doing this, Mom and Dad. You need to recycle. You need to stop what you're doing. You need to do things differently. And I often find that, you know, kids will poke their parents to do the right direction. They also get things early on, and that's really important that we could teach them early so they don't have to change their habits. They just get the best habits to start with. I'm a real believer. I don't have art degrees. I have education degrees, and that's you know, that's sort of my background that this comes from, is very much education.
That's terrific. Now, when you're getting, as far as responses from adults out there, you said that sometimes the scientists, the people who actually study animals, have given you a lot of compliments, and it's not just the artists who like your work, it's also the scientists, right?
Yeah, that's actually my favorite group to compliment me, because like that, we work really hard to be respectful to the animals. So I made an 18-foot-long weedy sea dragon that I just love. The animals are an amazing creature. They look like Dr. Seuss created them. But I study the animals really carefully, and I make sure that, like, all the appendages are the right shape and size and placement, and the fins are in the right place, and they're, you know, all the anatomy, as much as you can with garbage. I mean, you know, there's only so much you can do. But, you know, I look really carefully at, you know, the everything. You know, like in the blue marlin, when I made that, I realized I was looking up closely at the eyes, and their pupils weren't exactly round on any of them, and they were, you know, iridescent. So I purposely made sure that was in there. And that's, I just feel like that is respectful to the animals, and it gives them a voice, and that kind of authenticity shines through and is appreciated.
Mm-hmm. You depend basically on an army of volunteers to collect all this trash. So if people do want to get involved with the Washed Ashore project, are you in need of more volunteers? And what could people do
all
if they
the
do
time.
Want to get involved?
All the time. Well, we also are partners with Solve. So every time they have one of those big beach cleanups twice a year in September and March, you know, head to the beach and go get garbage off. And that stuff, we send trucks up and down the coast to pick that stuff up and bring it back to Washed Ashore down in Bandon. And then, you know, actually we have had garbage mailed to us, but do make sure you wash it first, because the post office doesn't really like stinky things, as we don't either, but we are used to that. But and then just, you know, go to the Oregon Zoo exhibit and you know, bring your family and, you know, come visit us in Bandon. And then, you know, go to our website, washedashore.org, and we have a list of all the other shows we have going on right now out and about. We're kind of in between shows. We're about to put up a show down in Florida, and we have one in Vancouver, B.C. We have one right now in Tulsa, Oklahoma. So we're all over the country, too.
Wow, and I see that 14,000 hours have been contributed by your volunteers, which is really quite significant. So start to finish, how much time goes into each sculpture? I'm sure it varies with the size.
Yeah, it's pretty hard. It's pretty hard to say that. But each panel is like a 6x6 inch piece of hardware cloth that people drill holes and wire stitch on the plastic to. And each one of those takes about an hour. And I'd say some of these sculptures have thousands of those in them. And then, of course, it takes a while to do all the detail work, the artistic. I have a wonderful apprentice that works with me, and we have an art assistant as well to do some of the finish work and the things like that. But just washing the garbage and collecting it and preparing it and putting on workshops, we like to have at least 6 months to a year to create a sculpture, but we have whipped them out faster than that when we've had to. But it depends on the other thing, as it's funny, is that some colors are very hard to come by, so you have to collect them for years in order to get enough to make a sculpture with. Brown, for instance, we're collecting brown right now because we'd like to do an eagle. But if someone commissions us to do a sea lion, then the eagle will have to go on hold because we'd have to use the brown for the sea lion. So that's how we'd have to think.
So if people want to see Daisy the polar bear or some of your other works of art, they could see that. Actually, they can see Daisy right now during Zoo Lights at the zoo.
Yeah.
But I am also seeing that you have exhibits, as you mentioned, in the Tulsa Zoo in Tulsa, Oklahoma, Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History in Washington, D.C., and, of course, in Bandon, in which you have an exhibit going on Thursday through Saturday, 12 to 5. People can come there, and you have volunteer workshops on Thursday through Saturdays. What do you teach in the volunteer workshops?
Well, we kind of set it up like stations, so people can just come in and like in one of the stations, you just sort plastics. It's all been washed, and you just help us sort it by color, and that helps educate you as to what's really going on and what's out there. Plus, it's kind of interesting, and then you also help us, in the stages of that. There's another station where you can make some corals that we're making out of cut-up buoys. Another station, we have two different stations for the condor that we're working on, the black feathers and the white feathers. Mm. And we're making a giant sea jelly right now, and you can help us tie things onto the frame, tie rope onto the frame, and make trash kebabs that basically strung plastics that we use for various things. So it changes all the time, but we're going to also be making another giant rockfish that we got a grant from Travel Oregon that we'll be working on that. That'll be a permanent piece down here in Bandon as well. And there's also a tufted puffin out on the bluff of Coquille Point in Bandon to enjoy as well.
So obviously the work of a lot of people go into each one of these sculptures. How does collaboration play into the creation of, new art pieces? Art is so often the solo endeavor. Was this sort of collaborative effort something you had always envisioned?
Yeah, it's, I kind of come from a little bit of a performing arts background too, and so I've always loved the collaboration part of things, but it's a tricky thing. You know, when I first started, it's not something I've done, and not something a lot of visual artists do, is work with other people all the time, and you have to design things that they can do successfully, that they can do and still be creative with, but also will fit to the bigger picture. And when you're making something really huge, like a 16-foot-long parrotfish, you need to have a lot of little pieces all put that together. Or with Daisy the polar bear, all those fur pieces were all stitched together by volunteers. But to have it look effective, you have to have sort of a criteria. And that comes where my teaching comes in, where, I set a criteria that this is what you need to have it look like, or this is sort of what we're going for, and then, get it all put together. And then, artists can come down and work with us for a while, and I sometimes when we do, my apprentice pretty much did a whole piece on his own, and I kind of collaborated with him, but he was the leader of it because he's really learning to get that. And so, yeah, it's tricky because you have to work with things that you can't go get more of if you want them. You have to accept whatever there is and however much there is and what it is. And and you have to work with lots of volunteers. And that's a challenge creatively. I love it. I love it. But it's not for everybody.
Well, we've loved having you here today with us. Thank you for joining us, Angela, here on Cable.
I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Angela Hazelton-Potsey is an Oregon-based artist, and she's the founder of the Washed Ashore Project. You can see her sculptures made of trash collected along the ocean at the Oregon Zoo, and she's also had her work appear at the Smithsonian. And you can also go online to learn more about her and her work at washedashore.org. Thanks for listening to KBOO News In Depth.